Please welcome Dr. Dale Meyer.
Thank you, Dr. Nielsen, and thanks to every one of you for staying. I thought everybody'd be gone by now. Maybe your plane isn't leaving till later. Whatever the reason be, thank you for staying. Let me also say by way of introduction, this to my students. I'm an eccentric and a fanatic on preaching from memory on Sunday morning, okay? But this is a different situation. And man, I'm reading. I don't want to get hung by something I said off the cuff. You can hang me by what I read. And the third preliminary remark, I really sincerely thank the Board of Regents and President Johnson for calling me back to the seminary. The duties of the Bennett Chair are some of the most challenging but also satisfying that I've had in almost 30 years of ministry, and I pray that I'll be able to return some of that trust to seminary and church by relevant service. Public ministry in the public realm is not only a theological consideration. It is also a constitutional matter, very much so. While our public ministry as Lutherans is normed by Scripture and the confessions, our activity in the public realm as American Lutherans is also normed by the constitutions, the judicial interpretations, and the administrative decisions of federal, state, and local governments. As we prepare to go home, I want to share some observations about how those norms of the public realm can be expected to affect us in the years to come. In this paper, I'll show first that church-state issues go back to the founding of our nation, which means that they are not the products of the exploding pluralism of contemporary society. Second, I'll share why I believe that we can expect more government interference in our public ministry, especially in those areas where our confessional positions conflict with American civil religion. Thirdly, I'll propose that we are squandering the insights of the two kingdoms and are not contributing to the good of our country if we do not literally take our bodies and minds out of the relatively cloistered and unchallenged surroundings of seminary and church and into the public realm, then teach our laity to do the same. And finally, I'll close with some simple suggestions. Anecdotes do not establish principles, but I believe the following anecdote reflects how we in the office of ministry can easily and without controversy take our witness into the public realm. Over the last decade, I have frequently visited the Capitol Hill Club in Washington, D.C., which is literally one block away from the Capitol building. Down in the lower level of that club, in a place called the Auschenschloss Grill, you find the stereotypical political room, filled with suits and skirts, smoke and drink, and where almost all the talk is politics. One evening, I was sitting alone at a table with Congressman Jim Saxton of New Jersey. The congressman turned to me and said, "Dale, I have a question." He proceeded to tell me that he had attended the baptism of a grandchild and heard a sermon about love, in which the minister said we would be better off if the nations of the world would show love to one another. Then Congressman Saxton went on to tell me how he chairs a subcommittee of the House of Representatives that is focused upon terrorism. Love? He said the terrorists want to kill us. "Dale, I have a question." And his question was how to reconcile those two facts, the Christian duty to love and his duty to protect us from the deadly intentions of our enemies. And by the way, that conversation took place many months before September 11th of 2001. Well, a Lutheran pastor instinctively knows how to address this Christian congressman's dilemma. I applied the two kingdoms to his situation and assured him that his activity on the subcommittee was not violating love. And just last week, he was kind enough to tell me again how helpful that Lutheran advice was. As we prepare to go home from this fine gathering, my encouragement is that we all put ourselves into those situations where people in the public realm will look to you and say, "I have a question." Let me go into more detail why more and more we need to be in the public realm in one-on-one relationships. I say more detail, but the issues will be still treated in a rather superficial way because of time. The Constitution of the United States was adopted on September 17, 1787, 215 years ago, last Tuesday. And there was only one reference to religion in the Constitution proper. Article 6, Section 3 says, "No religious test shall ever be required as a qualification to any office or public trust under the United States." On December 15, 1791, 4 years later, 10 of 12 proposed amendments were ratified by the states, giving us the Bill of Rights. The First Amendment says, "Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion," and that is shorthandedly referred to as the Establishment Clause, "or prohibiting the free exercise thereof," that is the Free Exercise Clause. And it goes on to say, "or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press or the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances." While contemporary Americans assume that the First Amendment establishes a wall of separation between church and state, it does not, or at least it did not when it was passed. The Establishment Clause comes out of a context that reaches back into European history. In the late 16th century, Richard Hooker defended the Anglican established church in England as a middle ground between Catholicism and Puritanism. Philip Hamburger writes, this comes from a brand new book, The Separation of Church and State. He writes that according to Hooker, the arguments of the dissenters against the government-appointed Anglican prelacy did not make sense, and now quoting Hooker, "unless they, against us, should hold that the church and the commonwealth are two both distinct and separate societies, of which two the one comprehendeth always persons not belonging to the other." That is, the separation of church and state, that phrase, was used by Hooker and other defenders of the establishment as a reproach against those who did not want an establishment, but also did not want a complete separation. It was not originally used as a positive word by dissenters. In 17th century New England, Roger Williams did adopt separation in a positive and radical way. Hamburger writes, "so severe was Williams' division between the spiritual and the worldly that they seemed almost irrelevant to each other, leaving worldly activities, or at least those so specialized as to seem secular, unburdened by spiritual concerns." What had been used as a reproach now becomes a positive in church-state relationship discussions. And I note that Roger Williams was anti-clerical. He said, "I am bold to maintain that it is one of the grand designs of the Most High to break down the hireling ministry that trade, faculty, calling, and living by preaching. Spoken or unspoken, anti-clericalism, which being interpreted is anti-you and me, was and continues to be a factor in church-state debates. So also Thomas Paine. In the late 18th century, Paine held that, quote, the connection of church and state was the means by which churches, whether the Jewish church, the Roman church, or the Greek church, had enlisted the power of government to suppress doubts about the truth of their doctrines. Therefore, a revolution in government was necessary to end the adulterous connection of church and state. So there was, at the founding, a lively debate between advocates of establishment. And you may know some of the colonies had established churches. And then with advocates like Williams and Paine of separation. The dissenters against establishment eventually prevailed, and the extreme separatists did not. Hamburger writes, a prohibition of all legislation with respect to religion may have been considered too broad by some dissenters. In particular, it might have precluded legislation protecting the free exercise of religion or otherwise concerning religion without establishing it. Americans of many persuasions, both dissenters and members of establishments, had argued that not only constitutions, but also more generally, governments should protect individuals in the free exercise of religion. To distill that quotation, the dissenters who did not want an established church also did not want a prohibition against religious legislation. Okay? Hence, the First Amendment was passed with both a non-establishment clause and the free exercise clause. The idea that church and state should be separate, as understood today, was not the understanding when the First Amendment was ratified. That idea started to come into play in the election of 1800. In that election, Federalist clergymen in New England, that is, clergymen who followed Alexander Hamilton and favored a more centralized government. And throughout American history, early American history, we had the continuing debate between the Hamiltonians and the followers of Madison and Jefferson. The Federalist clergy criticized candidate Thomas Jefferson for not being a Bible-believing, practicing Christian. The same criticisms came up in the election of 1860 when Lincoln was running. He was not a church-going Christian. And during our lifetime, we can document how criticisms were made of President Clinton during the first campaign. For example, now Jefferson had written in 1782, quote, the legitimate powers of government extend to such acts, nota bene, acts, only as are injurious to others. But Jefferson wrote, it does me no injury for my neighbor to say that there are 20 gods or no god. It neither picks my pocket nor breaks my leg. The Federalist clergy didn't like that and attacked Jefferson from their pulpits. The supporters of Jefferson responded by saying that politics has no place in the church. For example, Abraham Bishop wrote, certainly, those men must be eminent among delinquents who, spurning at expediency, neglecting a profession which requires all their faculties, neglecting the families of the sick and the dying, neglecting alarmed consciences and inquiring souls, devote their time and talents to the interests of a political party which has set itself up in opposition to the general government. That is the context in which President Jefferson wrote his much-quoted letter to the Danbury Baptist Association in 1802. He wrote, "Believing with you, the Baptists, that religion is a matter which lies solely between man and his God, that man owes account to none other for his faith or his worship, that the legislative powers of the government reach actions only," again, note actions only, "and not opinions, I contemplate with sovereign reverence that act of the whole American people, First Amendment, which declared that their legislature should make no law respecting an establishment of a religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, thus building a wall of separation between church and state." I won't get into this because of time, but when we trace this through the 19th century, another powerful factor fueling the growth of this separation mentality was anti-Catholic, anti-Roman Catholic sentiment. In summary, to this point, the Establishment Clause was at face value simply that, an amendment prohibiting the establishment of a national church or established churches in the states. Beyond that, room was left for an evolution of working out the implications. In retrospect, we see three basic positions on the relation of church and state. On one side was the possibility of establishing a national church or churches in the states. The First Amendment rejected that with the Establishment Clause, but with the Free Exercise Clause, it did not prohibit religious legislation. On the other side were the advocates of separation. Second option. It is their strict view that has evolved to be our popular understanding of the Establishment Clause, although that was not the original intent. When we see in these debates, what we see in these debates is a middle, a third way between establishment and complete separation, a way wherein church and state had certain connections that were generally accepted. These three positions have modern counterparts. When you see or hear media offerings of some evangelicals, you start to think that they are yearning for some unofficial establishment of a conservative evangelicalism, a Christian America. Under the fuzzy assertion that America was founded as a Christian nation, attempts are made to influence legislation in accordance with the morals of evangelical Christians. So, for example, James Dobson. He wrote in a May newsletter, "There are those within the church who remain convinced that it isn't our place to make our voices heard on these issues." And to show that Dobson is talking about more than a two-kingdom approach, he takes some swipes at, among others, Cal Thomas. He quotes Thomas, "There is no biblical mandate for reforming the world through government." And he also quotes my favorite from Thomas, "The kingdom of God is not going to arrive aboard Air Force One." That'll preach, brethren, that'll preach. A second example is the evangelical support for Israel that is prompted in some measure by dispensationalist theology. Now, I'm not saying their goal is a legal establishment, but they are striving for an America that reflects Christianity in its public policies. And if the 1800 election offers an analogy, the efforts of the religious right will produce a counter-reaction that will not be helpful to any of us. Another movement towards some de facto establishment today comes from the civil religion. The reaction to the Pledge of Allegiance controversy demonstrates how civil religion is receiving some official sanction. Politicians from both sides of the aisle rushed to condemn the attack on the pledge by the California lawsuit and provided news outlets with photo ops of them putting their lives on the line to recite the pledge. "Under God," they said loudly. What it means is not important. This is our amorphous civil religion, which is believed, taught, and confessed, as it were, by the media. It feels good, but has no telling impact on the nation's business. And thus, for example, when the Senate Judiciary Committee holds hearings on judicial appointments, a nominee's strong moral conviction against abortion is held to be out of the mainstream, not in accord with the civil religion, and therefore cause for rejection, which seems to me to be a religious test in reverse, harking again to Article 6 of the Constitution. Now, about this dominance of civil religion through media and specific legislation and acts of government bureaucracy, and it's not just Constitution, and it's not just legislation. Government bureaucracy and regulatory agencies are a factor here as much as anything. But talking about this, James Madison wrote in Federalist Paper number 51 something worthy to keep in mind. Madison wrote, "In a society under the forms of which the stronger faction can readily unite and oppress the weaker, anarchy may truly be said to reign as in a state of nature, where the weaker individual is not secured against the violence of the stronger. It's not simply the will of the majority that should decide church-state issues. It is especially the protection of minorities, religious minorities, that our Constitution is concerned to protect." At the other extreme are those who argue for strict separation. Unlike Jefferson and his allies, but like Williams and Paine, many modern separation advocates want to establish a radical separation that will admit no hint of God or religion in public life. We hear of their efforts all the time. Manger scenes, the Ten Commandments in courthouses, prayer in public schools, vouchers, chaplains in the military and in legislatures, and the like. While this extreme separation is not thought of in terms, traditional terms of establishment, it does bear some of the marks in a negative sort of a way. Again, I'm not saying these groups are pursuing establishment in the historical sense, but people of conviction, whatever their conviction happens to be, want to fill in the blank, in blank we trust, with their own understanding of how it should be. What I see happening now is a movement toward a mediating position, away from establishment, away from strict separation, and toward an acknowledgement of the connection that exists between church and state. Perhaps the best evidence of this mediating position that is coming to the fore is the current administration's focus on faith-based initiatives. Dr. John DiIulio, the first director of the new White House Office of Faith-Based and Community Initiatives, spoke in Dallas last year to the National Association of Evangelicals, and he quoted a number of statements from President Bush, some of which I'll share. The president said one time, "I strongly respect the separation of church and state. I am a secular official," which is why he sometimes, I believe, for example, in quoting Romans 8, dropped off through Christ Jesus our Lord. He believes it, but he's a secular official in that function. Again, he said, "Government, of course, cannot fund and will not fund religious activities. Hence the debate about vouchers and how that money, or if that money, should be granted." And as you know, the court, in a 5-4 decision, said it's constitutional. Again, the president, "We will not fund the religious activities of any group, but when people of faith provide social services, we will not discriminate against them." And finally, from the executive order in which he established the faith-based office in January of last year, "The paramount goal is compassionate results, and private and charitable groups, including religious ones, should have the fullest opportunity permitted by law to compete on a level playing field, so long as they achieve valid public purposes. The delivery of social services must be results-oriented and should value the bedrock principles of pluralism, non-discrimination, even-handedness, and neutrality." This mediating position, which the current administration has thrust to the fore, is consistent with where America has been since the founding. Quoting the Virginia Gazette of 1785, civil government always has called in the influences of religion to its assistance and support, and in the nature of things must always do so. And should the administration, now I'm gone from 1785 to today, this is Dale again, I'm glad you ask. And if the administration should change, faith-based initiatives will not disappear. Under charitable choice, community organizations, both religious and secular, can apply for government support. Charitable choice was signed into law by President Clinton in 1996. It was not a Bush initiative. This mediating position is going to continue. And furthermore, the bureaucracy has been put into place in Washington and in the states, and we all know that once a bureaucracy exists, it will not be dislodged. So, the religious right, civil religion, and extreme separatists will try to fill in the blank wherever they can, and we can expect more controversy. The contested issues will more and more affect the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod and will be addressed through the judicial system. In a Supreme Court opinion from 1940, the case of Minersville School District versus Gobitis, this was a Pledge of Allegiance case. Justice Jackson wrote about, quote, the task of translating the majestic generalities of the Bill of Rights. And that is precisely where we are at and will be more and more in the future. The Establishment Clause is one of those majestic generalities that's going to be translated into reality, battled out in the courts. And to that, I now turn. Catherine Cookson has written 2001, it's a new book, relatively new book from Oxford, called Regulating Religion. It's an examination of the courts, and now we shift ahead to the Free Exercise Clause, how the courts since the founding have interpreted the Free Exercise Clause. In her examination of Supreme Court decisions on cases of religious liberty shows us laymen. And in the public realm, we are laymen. Two things. First, the interpretation of the Free Exercise Clause has shifted over the years. And second, the direction of some who now sit on the court should be of concern to us. Skimming over Supreme Court history. The first time that the court dealt in a significant way with the Free Exercise Clause was in 1879 when it heard Reynolds versus the United States. Reynolds was a Mormon who had been convicted of polygamy under the Moral Anti-Polygamy Act of 1874. Chief Justice Morrison Waite wrote the majority of opinion for the court, and he acknowledged, according to Cookson, that Reynolds proved at trial, one, that the practice of polygamy was a doctrine of the Mormon Church. Two, that the Mormons believed that God had directly commanded them to undertake the practice. And three, that the Mormons were convinced that one would suffer damnation in the afterlife for failure or refusal to practice polygamous marriage. I don't have the time to make jokes. And my wife is here, too. The Mormons' practice thus came within the general rubric of the phrase exercise of religion. In other words, the Mormons had proven that polygamy was a religious obligation, but the court ultimately held that the Free Exercise Clause of the Constitution did not include the right to freely exercise the religious practice of polygamy. Cookson says the court ultimately concluded that the federal Free Exercise Clause was, in actuality, a freedom of religious belief clause, which merely protected religious opinion. And the position of the court in Reynolds was drawn in part from Jefferson's letter to the Danbury Baptist Association, in which, you remember, he said, the legislative powers of the government reach actions only and not opinions. The decision in 1897 in Reynolds established a conclusive presumption for statute, and it restricted free exercise. That is, you can believe whatever your religion teaches you to believe, but if you go out into the public realm and violate a statute, you will be found guilty. This view held until 1940, when a shift took place in Cantwell versus Connecticut. This case was about a Jehovah's Witness named Cantwell, who with his two sons had been charged with breaking the peace. I have to interject here that these court cases generally came from groups that we at the seminary would say, these are fringe groups, we don't bother with them, we can categorize them as cultish or whatever. They're the groups, though, that have helped establish a lot of the precedents that come into play when, let us say, the Missouri Synod files a brief or is defending something in court. So we shouldn't be so quick to dismiss those groups out of hand. They're the forerunners of Islam and other Sikhs and so on today. In Cantwell, the court found that religiously compelled behavior, although a violation of the common law of crime of incitement to a breach of peace, quote, raised no such clear and present menace to public peace and order as to render him liable to conviction of the common law offense in question. In reaching this decision, the court determined that the constitutional guarantees of the free exercise of religion and speech should be given equal consideration with society's interest in good order. That is, in Cantwell, the court said that there is not a conclusive presumption in favor of the state, thus reversing the standard it had laid down in Reynolds. Instead, the court concluded that each free exercise case should be adjudicated on the basis of the issues unique to that case. And if across the broad territory of the United States of America there are contradictions in practice, the Cantwell decision says, so be it. A third case, this from 1990. Cantwell was 1940, now 1990. This is the Employment Division versus Smith. This case started when Alfred Smith and Galen Black, both members of the Native American Church, were relieved of their duties as drug counselors because of their sacramental use of peyote, which is like some kind of drug, you know. And that was their sacrament. Okay. The Supreme Court ruled against Smith and Black. Justice Antonin Scalia wrote for the majority. He said, respondents, that's Smith and Black, urge us to hold, quite simply, that when otherwise prohibitable conduct is accompanied by religious convictions, not only the convictions, but the conduct itself must be free from government regulation. Remember the distinction between action and opinion, okay? Say that again. Scalia says that when otherwise, the respondents urge, when otherwise When otherwise prohibitable conduct is accompanied by religious convictions, not only the conviction, but the conduct itself must be free from government regulation. That was Cantwell. But he says, we have never held that and decline to do so now. There being no contention that Oregon's drug law represents an attempt to regulate religious beliefs, the communication of religious beliefs, or the raising of one's children in those beliefs, the rule to which we have adhered ever since Reynolds plainly controls. Now, Cookson really goes after that paragraph, and we won't get into that, except that it does not match up with Cantwell and other cases. Cookson summarizes, the religious practice violated the generally applicable drug laws of the state of Oregon, and any practice which is a crime automatically loses free exercise clause protections. The government must be allowed to regulate for the good of everyone, and it cannot be concerned with a myriad of religious practices in this pluralist society. Thus, the court today seems to have returned to a conclusive presumption for the state and against those who claim free exercise. And this should be worrisome to us. Imagine that a confessional practice of our church, for example, our refusal to ordain women or to hire homosexuals for certain positions, were challenged by a bureaucracy of the government. This conclusive presumption for the state immediately puts us on the defensive, and it makes us unlikely that we could defend our confessional practice. Now, I hasten to add that Title VII, Section 702 of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 permits religious organizations to discriminate in employment on the basis of religion, but regulatory agencies can still cause trouble, as the KFUO licensing case taught us some years ago. The drift of the court today is that we can hold whatever religious opinion we want, but we had better not violate any statute. And so the middle ground between establishment and separation is going to be a contentious place, and the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod can expect to be drawn in. And if we had the time, I could go on and on and on with more examples, including a bill that is scheduled to come up on the House floor on September 30th by suspension, and that is a contentious and troublesome thing. But that's for another day. Let me now draw some conclusions. My wife, Diane, remember Professor Eichmann, I always say my wife, Diane, and he said, well, how many wives do you have? You have a wife, Judy, a wife, Sally, a wife, Sarah. My wife, Diane, serves on the City Council of Collinsville, Illinois, a town of about 25,000. When she was first elected, we would talk about some city issue that was on her mind, and I would offer my advice. She invariably told me why my advice wouldn't work. And upon reflection, and I hate to say this, I saw that she was right. She spoke as a local politician and elected official. I spoke as a pastor. This illustrates a more general truth about us, especially us clergy, in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. No offense, but we are neophytes when it comes to the realities of church-state issues in our country. Washington, D.C. is packed with denominational and parachurch offices that have had long histories and deep expertise in working church-state issues. 2 weeks ago, I had lunch with the general counsel of the Joint Baptist Committee. They've been there for most of the 20th century. And outside of Washington, the same programs in church and state public policy show that we are way behind. Outside of Washington, D.C., there are also organizations and universities that have programs in church and state public policy, and they too demonstrate that we are way behind the learning curve. While our theological understanding of the two kingdoms is full of practical insight for Christian life in this democracy, and I'm not questioning the two kingdoms, it's marvelous, and were the time existent, the two kingdoms seen through the light of the Enlightenment are what have really put in place the American attitude toward church and state. And I can't go off on that trip, but the two kingdoms and the Enlightenment have influenced the government under which we live and have been blessed in church-state ways in the United States. At any rate, we have taught the two kingdoms, but we have not taken the two kingdoms into the public realm. When we get into the nitty-gritty of the public realm, whether that be federal, state, or local, we will find, my first conclusion, that we are newcomers to long-standing discussions. Second, we will quickly learn that the public realm has little patience for our extended theological discussions. Do you remember from yesterday's reading in chapel how Festus and Agrippa shut Paul off as he was talking theology? Increasingly, the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod finds some of its vital issues being considered by administrative branches of federal and state government, by the legislative branches, and ultimately by the judiciary. Should the courts continue their shift to a conclusive presumption in favor of statute and at the expense of free exercise, the niceties in which Lutheran theologians delight will not be admitted to the discussion. I'm reminded of a scene from the old movie on the life of Martin Luther. Charles V demonstrates no patience for the fine points the Wittenberg monk is making. The emperor wants an immediate answer, and the theologically sensitive Luther shows himself a stranger to the ways of the public forum. Whether that scene is historically true or not, I don't know. But I do know for a fact that theological niceties, important as they are, will often not be allowed in state house or courtroom debate. Courts are not arbiters of scriptural interpretation, wrote the Supreme Court in Thomas versus Review Board in 1981. What we don't know well enough is how the public realm really works. Third conclusion, it is a wonderful thing from God that we do have lay people within and without the synod who do know how the public realm really works. Since the public realm is dominated by the laity, many of whom are true Christians, let's equip them by teaching the how-tos of sanctification. The vast social ministry efforts of Lutherans demonstrate, among other efforts of our people, that our people have a desire to do the good works of the second table of the law in the public realm. We are blessed among denominations with fantastic insight, learned insight into the doctrine of justification. If we cannot teach sanctification, then who in the world can? When we fail to give our parishioners proper and relevant instruction on how sanctification can be pursued in their daily lives in the public realm, we are creating, or we have created, a void that other ministries are filling. And you've seen what's offered at your local Christian bookstore. Let's not run from sanctification or rationalize our silence. Fourth, as we learn more about the realities of moving public ministry into the public square, we are going to face more and more difficult situations. My fourth recommendation is that we clergy revive the old practice of casuistry. Whatever position an individual may take on Yankee Stadium, however convinced a person may be in his or her own mind that the position is in accordance with the scriptures and the confessions, the rapid escalation of the event into a major controversy within the church shows the failure of our clergy to practice casuistry. For generations, pastoral conferences devoted a portion of their schedule to discussing specific cases of casuistry. This happened invariably. How do the grand truths of doctrine and the imperative of love apply to problematic cases? That's what casuistry addresses. If our clergy were still in the regular habit of casuistry, the Yankee Stadium event would not have gone, as one of my colleagues says, from 0 to 60 in 5 seconds. We need to resurrect casuistical discussion in our circuit pastoral conferences, not simply on questions of unionism and syncretism, but on all issues that can arise in modern pastoral ministry. Without an aptitude for casuistry on any issues, we will fail to do casuistry on specific, troubling church-state unionism-syncretism issues. So those are my simple suggestions that will, I believe, be of some help to our church without getting you individually into a stadium of controversy. Since the public realm is populated by the laity, let us teach them how to exercise their freedom of religion in scriptural and confessional ways by making faith active through love, through the works of the second table. And since our ministerium as a whole is unfamiliar with the real workings of the public realm, and again, as I said in chapel, there are public realms. I found out during my years with the Lutheran Hour that, 90% more of our people and pastors really don't understand how media works in this day and age. There are public realms. But since the public realms are populated by the laity, let's teach them how to exercise their freedom of religion in scriptural and confessional ways by making faith active through love. I read that before, through the works of the second table. And since our ministerium as a whole is unfamiliar with the real workings of the public realms, let's admit that we have much to learn from the lay people who work in it. And we'll come to appreciate that the cases are not always easy, and so a revival of the practice of casuistry will benefit the church. Shortly after he was appointed chaplain of the House of Representatives, I visited with Father Coughlin in his Capitol office. He's a very nice man, except that his mother is an usher for the Chicago Cubs, but I'm trying to deal with that. When I asked Father Coughlin if he had a list of ministries that are active in Washington, he chuckled. There are more denominational and parachurch ministry presences in D.C. than we can imagine. Contrary to popular opinion, most congressmen and senators are moral people, and many of them are Christ-confessing, Bible-believing Christians. I have often talked with the members of Congress and their staffers about God and Jesus. Our federal, state, and local capitals are not God-forsaken places. They just have been largely forsaken by the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. So I trust that you will go home stimulated by what you have heard these days, thankful that your seminary has provided this forum for civil, intellectual discussion about the vital issues of public ministry in the public realm. When I go back to Washington the week after next, people down in that smoke-filled room will greet me by name and talk with me about what's going on in their lives. And in return, I'll share what's happening in my life, my faith, and the two kingdoms with them. As you go home and get to know some of the people who tend the public realm in your corner of the world. Get to know them so that they will call you by name and say, "I have a question." Thank you.